Welcome to Tips for Azure. We're going to have a little fireside chat amongst the two or three of us. And I'm going to take you down a couple of different paths here because we're going to put the hat of the architect a little bit, the hat of the developer a little bit, the hat of the entrepreneur. Because that's the most important one, right? I think. So my name is Michelle de Rubis-Demonte. Nice to meet you, all of you. I'm an architect with iDesign. I do high-end architecture consulting for customers. I've been helping people with Azure for several years now, early adopters, of course. Spent a lot of time in security as well, as you may also know, a lot of identity federation type focus. Been part of many startups through my career. Been helping a lot of startups and starting a few startups with some very talented people of late in the past few years, even sold one. And I'm here to talk to you about some of those experiences. So, a little fireside chat, like I said. My blog is michellerubisdevante.com, and that will be where I post the code for this talk. There will be code that is very, very big, and that's why I'm not going to upload it from my hotel, because, well, I discovered a lot of interesting things about Lucene indexes and the size of the Azure package and things that I need to do to get those uploaded. And so we'll be taking care of that when I'm at a faster internet connection than the Rosen Plaza. Thank you very much. If you're staying there, you know what I'm talking about, right? Can I get a hey?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. But it's all good. We're here to talk. So, the dream startup. The cloud has made us all entrepreneurs, yes? Anybody can put something in the cloud and try to make money. And you know what? It's actually quite a vibrant community now. I mean, I don't know if you follow any of the VC blogs or pay attention to the startup community. I do. And I find it to be extremely, vibrant right now. Lots of good ideas, lots of bad ideas. Everybody's got a good idea. I can't speak for your ideas. Heck, we probably most of the time can't speak for our own ideas. All we can do is try, right? So we got to try the best we can. You got an idea? You think it might work? You code, code, code. I don't code like that, but same. You put it in the cloud after you code, code, code. And then the people come, and they say, this is awesome. I know. Am I dreaming? No, maybe not, right? It can happen. Pinterest, hello, right? What's that all about? Cupcakes, recipes? They're going to make money, right? There's lots of interesting ideas. So that's what we want, right? The end of the rainbow. And I guess I start with this slide only to share with you that, there's obviously a lot that goes into building a startup, getting a team together, assembling a proper process, getting stuff actually into the cloud safely, but we're really enabled right now to do it quick and fast. And I think that in particular, the tools that we have with Azure help us as developers to be more IT people a little bit, right? We can get it deployed and kind of trust that it's out there and, replicated, triple replicated data, triple replicated instances, failover as long as I have two instances, blah, 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 right? We got programs like BizSpark to help us save money, and it can make it pretty close to free in some cases for like the first 2 years of your service if you get part of that program. So there's a lot of interesting things that you can do to try to be successful on little money so that you can hopefully build something and see if you can make more. Now, there's a lot that goes on in here. What features should you lead with? Wow, that's a business decision. I can't help you there right now because, you all have probably different ideas. What features you should lead with are really important though because you got to show traction. VCs want to see traction today, right? Got to lead with something that you can show I'm getting more users. Additional users are being added to my system, right? People are interested. You want to go fast and maintain quality. So this is a really important one. Sometimes people ask me in the VC community, why Azure, right? Because there are a lot of communities out there that think, you know, wow, you can slam out some PHP and get it up there and do a pretty good job. A lot of college kids, right, making a lot of code, drinking a lot of Jolt. And that's one way to go. But if you're trying to build a real business, right, it's kind of nice to think that you could be agile, but also have some level of quality and some level of design and some level of planning for vNext, right? This is a team that can take you from here to we actually have users, right? So I think that that's important. And I think that the right VCs also think that's important. You have to monitor them, right? So you need to be able to show that you've got users being added to your system. Diagnostics helps you with that. Google Analytics helps you with that. I'm not going to go into that, but that's just an important point, right? Things that you can do to find out what kind of traction are we gaining. You can just monitor your tables. You know, how many users are we getting per day? You can have performance counters for those things, right? And then you want to watch for conversion rates. What's that? Well, when somebody comes to the site, do they create an account? Do we make it easy enough for them to do that? Hopefully, right? And if we do, then away we go. So I'm going to go through a bunch of tips. And I could slam a bunch of code down your throat, but I mean, you know, some of them will be code-centric, some of them will be talking-centric, because you can always look at code later, and we want to talk, because there's a lot to talk about here, really. And this is just a short list of things that I've discovered or seen in the various startups. And, you know, like I said, if you want to spend like a whole day, we could probably talk about more, but we won't, because my voice won't last that long, I'm sure. By the way, my son is 4, and when I cough, he thinks it's hilarious, I've discovered. So he laughs his butt off when I cough, and he says, "Mama, cough again." That's really refreshing. So if I have a coughing attack, feel free to laugh, because like maybe it'll make me feel like I'm home. Thanks. Okay, tip number one, design for role scale out. I think this is important. Your cloud project has, you know, the usual stuff, the service definition. You've got many roles or maybe one role, and this is the important question. Within a role, you can have many sites. Within a site, you can have virtual directories and applications, if you're talking IIS. You've got entry points and endpoints for communication. So this is the Azure structure that you're probably already familiar with. Roles are the important one for money. Now, it's not a lot of money, but if you're a startup of a couple of people and you're trying not to spend a few $100 a month, then it's important to you, right? Agreed. Because you don't want to go out of pocket more than you have to. So you want to think about how you can design to optimize the number of VMs, but still be available or able to scale it out later, which means design it so that maybe you've got subdomains and things like that architected and multiple sites within a single role architected. And then when you're ready to move it out to a separate role because you've got some people hitting the site and you're ready to scale, bam, that's when we do that. So quick set of visuals, right? This is probably pretty obvious. Don't sacrifice good design. You know, you've got a browser, you've got a website, maybe it's an MVC site with HTML5 CSS in the front. Maybe you got some JavaScript posting back. A lot of times we just end up spinning that up in a controller part of the MVC site, not a problem. Maybe that's calling back to some back-end services, could be, right? And if it's simple like this, then maybe we don't have any other controllers outside of that. But typically, your site's going to probably have some rich set of APIs that mobile devices are going to call, too. So I'm probably going to have things, and this is an example that's an IMDb search, and that's the big, huge, monstrous sample that, you know, you'll be able to play with that has Lucene indexes in it. And MovieDB search, MovieDB posters is just an example of a couple of APIs that the JavaScript is calling back to. Separating that so that it can be called, maybe, from elsewhere, right? So these could be MVC controllers or API web controllers, right? Either way. But maybe in a simple example, I might consider hosting this all in one site, right? Single site, single role, easy enough. If I want to plan for scale, And a funny thing happens when you design something and then you start to get busy and then you start to have deadlines and then you start to have to add stuff, and then all of a sudden you don't have the option or the opportunity to go back and redesign. So if you've thought about it up front, then hopefully you'll be able to just quickly spin out the changes without having to deal with delays, if that makes sense. So things like considering single role, multiple site, so that mobile devices in the future that require you to scale out those additional API services, because they're going to have a different set of load access patterns than your website, for example, right? So it might make sense that I start like this, where I have two sites within a single role, which we can do very easily, and then imagine that it grows to be this one day. What have I got here, right? I'm calling out to external third-party services over here on the right. I've got these blob storage items, which are Lucene indexes that are being loaded into the role instance so that they can be searched. I've got storage queue and service bus queues. We're going to talk about just comparing those and some of the decisions you have to make. And then I've got my web role and I've got my APIs. So how might I structure this short term, long term? Short term, maybe I've got two websites. And then maybe I put the worker just in one of those, you know, basically in the role entry point to go and read the queues. And then at some point, it's going to be time to scale out and I can go ahead and do this. So with some subdomain mapping and handling, you know, the right design in your service definition, you can lead to this just very easily. That's the message. And I'll just quickly give you an example of that, because this is one of the things that I've seen a lot of people get stuck with. But if I go over to, so multiple sites, one role, right? The idea is, by default, you usually get something like this. And instead, you have to come in and kind of manually edit it, tell it where the physical site is, and, you know, give it the same binding, right? So you're going to have that single endpoint still, but you can give it a different subdomain. I'm just using ABCXYZ for this example, to be simple. In order for me to test this locally, I got to have a simple host file, right? So I got to have something like this in here so that it'll be recognized. And then I can run it in Azure Emulator. And then when I go to deploy, we got to talk domain mapping, right? And CNAMEs or A records. Preferably A records because they're faster. And that's okay because that's not where I'm trying to go. And so ABC Boost Cloud, excuse me. Sorry, what am I doing? Okay. I had it right the other time. Oops, I didn't mean to click that. Okay. First demo working good. Wow. Okay. Sorry. Oh my goodness. Seriously? I don't know what I did. You kind of run stuff and it works, and then you run it and it's not working. Like right now. Yeah, that's kind of happening, but just give me one more second, and then otherwise I'll just, you know, recircle. Maybe see. It's just a refresh thing, like it's not, you know, picking it up. Yeah. Oh. Yeah, you're probably right. No, it's probably 82. You know what? It's a port thing. You're right. Thank you. Duh. Blonde moment in the flesh. Thank you, and that's okay. Did I mention, yeah, that coughing equals no sleep? Yes, thank you. So, you see that worked. Yeah, okay. Recovery from first demo. Nobody too excited about that. That's okay though. I can be excited in my head. And then I can save that. And then if we actually go to my management portal, I've already deployed that little guy up here under multi-site. And it's under, you know, Michelle Booster Cloud app.net. But basically I've got it here in, you know, pointing to this IP address. I went to GoDaddy. I pointed, you know, wildcard over here. And then basically when the subdomain comes in, I'm picking it up. So if we come up here now, I should be able to type it again, even though I commented at the local host, and it'll actually hit the one in the cloud. And not on 82, of course. Yeah. Yeah, there you go, refresh. Okay, so that's not really too difficult. I think it's just the point is that, you know, it's good to plan for these things, and I think designing for that up front is useful. So bottom line is, you know, your A records are faster mapping, and if you go there and make the wildcard mapping over to, you know, one location, one IP, that'll work fine. But you can actually register subdomains to specific IPs. So later when you scale out, you could send, you know, services dot or API dot over to some other subdomain and other IP address, and that will work just fine too, and then you can still catch all at the other IP address. So bottom line is, you know, planning for that up front is useful and it allows you to scale out. The kinds of things that get in the way there is just the rush of, okay, we're busy now, we don't have time to design better, and then we can't scale out as easily or whatnot, so it's just a little tip. Now, part of the one of the examples that, so I have this really large, you know, Lucene index example, the one that has trouble uploading. And this one has kind of everything in it, as I've shown you in the diagram. But I wanted to illustrate some other things. SMTP Relay is a popular thing to need to do, obviously, sending email from the cloud. From Azure, you can easily do a 127.0.0.1 port 25. Any other port that you open to do SMTP, you can change it with PowerShell. But if you do that, then you have to make sure you have full trust, which anybody usually has anyway. And then you're just using the SMTP client to send mail. So this is all pretty straightforward, you know, startup tasks, SMTP for dev is useful for local testing. So just, again, a tip on some of the things that come up frequently, and then we'll talk about maybe some gotchas. Coming over here, I've got an example. So this is kind of a combined queuing slash email example, but let's just talk about email for a sec. So the email utility is just going to write to a queue, and then when we pick up from the queue, we're going to send an actual email. Sending email is nothing special. Maybe when this is not so busy, I can go back to that code. And so basically, you know, you need to have obviously a from address, a to address. So the from address is kind of important. If it's not from the same domain as where you deployed, so that means staging or production, so cloudapp.net or your domain dot whatever, then it's probably going to go to spam, and that's a problem. So that's one thing that you have to make sure that you do correctly. But in addition, you probably have limited amount of relay anyways from Azure, because if it's not already blacklisted, it would be soon. So right now it's not blacklisted in the sense that I'm still getting emails from Azure. But what you need to do is use a Relay service, and you have to, you know, come up with a service that you'll pay for that. So obviously with the cloud, there's many providers. I have a couple listed in the slides that you could go to. So those are some important things. But as far as actually sending the email, it's, you know, you can look at the samples as well, but basically it's, you know, simple SMTP client, send mail, basic stuff. And probably the more important thing is, how do I set that up in Azure? So how do we do that? We've got to install SMTP, PowerShell. This only works, and this is probably one of the gotchas that gets people all the time, if your project is using OS Family 2. Otherwise, you have to do some additional work for PowerShell. So staying with OS Family 2 is probably, anyways, a better idea. If you stick with that, then you'll be able to do exactly what I'm showing here. Simple SMTP command, and then you have another couple of scripts here that are your typical VBS and PS1 files that are launched, right? So those are going to install SMTP and open the correct ports for you. There's other ways to do it. There's other PowerShell commands. I mean, if you're a PowerShell master, maybe you won't use these the same way, but the point is that's how you would get something rigged in Azure as part of the deployment, automated. Now, I think I'm running. And here, if I just send sort of like, you know, some sort of email. I'm listening with this tool called SMTP for Dev. This is really useful. So I got two messages because it's writing to two queues. The configuration by default is set up to send to two locations. And I'm just testing out the different types of queuing in order to give you an example that shows both. And if you inspect the message, you know, it just kind of saves you from having to go to Outlook and having to do all that kind of stuff. So on your local machine, SMTP for Dev. The sample shows you how to set it up. It's got a little README file that goes along with it, so you know how to use that. So it's just a, you know, free little tool, right? Okay. Now, this guy is also in the cloud, and if I go over here to this example, I can go ahead and send an email from here and see if I get a new email into my iDesign account. Now, this is an old one, so, you know, that just proves it worked, like, once, right? And then if I get another one, then we'll know, right? So right now, that's not 3:13 a.m., and I don't know what time zone my computer was set to when it said that, but, you know. I wonder why it's not working, she says inquisitively. If we go in here, one of the things that I can do is go into my configuration and try to edit that and see what's going on. And this is a nice segue into another thing that is probably one of the major gotchas, like most annoying things that you will be so happy if you avoid. And that is deploying something and then realizing you missed a setting. An interesting thing happens when you do multiple sites, like I showed you in the first example, and the second site that you add to the role is actually a directory that gets packaged up in the package. Do you want to know what happens when that happens? I'll show you. You go to the second site. So let's say I've got this, you know, big Lucene movie cloud demo, and I've got this API directory. Well, that API directory has a copy of all the indexes. It's 500 megabytes of love. And if I open this guy up in my API directory here, and I take a look at the indexes, it would say, along with other items, I'm not seeing it because I think I moved it out to prevent this from happening again. It says, you know, do not copy, right? And it says it's not content. It says none. I've already moved it out. That's why you're not going to see that right now. Just like in my main web role, I have the Lucene indexes because originally we were going there for the APIs. And you see, again, it's got no build action, do not copy. Problem is, because it's a second site, it packages up the whole dang thing and puts it all into the CS package. And so when I was wondering, and this maybe could have been a blonde moment, or it could have just been, you know, the first time I did something that had a 500 megabyte, you know, movie index in a directory as part of my second site, which would be the correct answer. And I realized why, after the fact, after I unzipped the package and checked it out, why is this 500 megabytes? So just a word to the wise, your second site doesn't obey this content setting. So if you have stuff in there that you're not planning to deploy and you're thinking it's not getting into the package, it's getting into the package. And that could kind of get in the way of fast uploads. But here's the thing, if you're doing this upload that takes like half an hour, and you realize you made a wrong setting, how pissed off do you think you're going to be if you didn't make it so that you could come in here and make a change? I'd say pretty. Just saying. Maybe that's funnier in my head, but I, you know, I'm not saying that happened to me. Might have. And I might have been a little upset. And I might have had to wait an hour or so, or two. But the point is, it's really important that you create a bunch of settings that could potentially be something you want to tweak during development lifecycle, during test lifecycle, and that change, obviously, between environments. That's the obvious thing. But it's not just changes between environments. It's really important that you also consider, you know, just stuff that you might want to play with at runtime. That could include the level that you want to write diagnostics to. That could include, you know, any number of settings in your application, like how long you would like to wait before you pull from queues to play with pricing numbers, things like that, that I might be segueing to, right? So really important that you come in here, and I think that, you know, one of the things that I have in here is I have my enable service bus queue set to false, which is why that email wouldn't have come through. So if I set it to true and turn on one of the queues, turn on two queues, click OK, and that's just a warning because I have a single instance because, you know, they want you to have two, right, for failover. And now it'll go ahead and update, right? So it's going to refresh my role and it's going to take all the new config settings. So you want to be respecting those. So that's kind of a segue to where we were. So we were talking about Relay. I showed you how to set up email. You can look at the code sample for deeper. It's not hard to come across all of those, you know, code samples that show that. But definitely consider the Relay, you know, using a third party. Obviously, you're going to need that for a real production site. You're not going to be using Azure to do that. And not everybody realizes that. So here's a couple examples of some good ones. Auth, SMTP, Django, and SendGrid. So just for your reference. Using configuration profiles, I just touched on that. You want to avoid web config for things that change between environments, that are things you might want to experiment with for performance and so forth, and diagnostics and testing. The default profiles that you get are configuration local, configuration cloud, but you can create copies of those, and I don't know if you're aware of this, you can create copies of those and create a bunch of other ones. So for example, for production, not everybody's going to be seeing that, right? It's not getting checked into TFS, et cetera. There's going to be hopefully an automated build process, but we're a startup, folks, right? We don't have all these people to create automated builds and so forth. So somebody's going to a machine somewhere, and they're loading up a config that only should be for their eyes and that shouldn't be checked in and that needs to have everything. So it's just a simple tip, but that's one of the things that you can do. when you're deploying, you can also pick a different web config transform, right? So if you haven't been using that, this is a really good time to do so. And I've been calling it by another name, but I guess, you know, the official name is transform. When you take a look at here, you know, your cloud configuration is probably going to be different from your local configuration, but if you look at, you know, the types of settings you might want to put in there, keys to things that, you know, you're testing in your testing environment, and then you're going to switch those when you go to production, they might be a different key, et cetera. You're going to have maybe URL paths that are changing, and sometimes you don't know what the port's going to be, and then you deploy and you have to make a switch there, that kind of thing. If you just make a copy and paste that into the project, that'll produce a new one. And then you can give it a name, your favorite name, whatever you like. I don't know if that's doing that right now, but I kind of intended it to. Oh, it's because I'm, yeah. It's probably wanting me to do source control, so I'll do it here. I did copy paste, copy paste. Not so fast. Okay, well, while that's thinking, because I'm sure it's got to be doing something, in your website, you know, the usual, these are the transforms, right? So you put your deltas in here, like anything that changes for the environment, and you can go ahead and pick those as you deploy. So when you go to publish, you probably have seen that you can come in here and choose the service configuration and then the build configuration. And it'll let you choose, you know, which web config from there. Okay. This is just an obvious thing, but I've seen a lot of, well, at least a few anyways, startups that didn't think they needed to go down the road of caching early on. And what happens is you don't realize how much latency you're paying for certain types of data. And it's really, you know, easy to use the cache. I won't even bother showing you the couple lines of code because you can look at the sample for that and there's lots of examples of that out there. But the point is, caching's obviously a lot better now and a lot more economical because you can start by using your existing roles, right? Which is something that has been announced recently. So the whole point is you can co-locate now. You've got your two instances of your web roles. Start with that. Allocate some small amount of memory on both of those machines to start with. You start seeing users increase. You start seeing that demand increase. If you spread out to more roles, you could continue to use your co-located roles, and it becomes one distributed cache across with a total. All the roles can talk to each of them. It's the same API. There's no change. And the point is that, you know, you're able to look at your data like, if I'm downloading thumbnails or this or that, and I don't want to have to go and get that from some remote API call, or I don't want to go get that from the database, then you can cache it and have it cycle FIFO. So the most commonly used things will just stay there. But be careful, you know, caching is not, you know, durable, right? I mean, it's not intended for, you know, it could be used for a shopping cart in a session, but, you know, in theory, right, that may not live forever, and if you want it to be absolutely durable, then you'd want to be using a persistent store instead, right? So think of it more like optimizations where it's nice to have. If it's not there, I'll just go get it where I'm supposed to get it. Otherwise, I'm here. And the performance increase is phenomenal when you look at the areas of your application that have high throughput, right? Again, high throughput or definitely, you know, heavy bandwidth usage, right? Or frequency of access to the database, for example, right? So you want to take a look at that and, you know, again, there's no risk allocating the memory, and then if you run out, it'll just start pushing stuff out of the queue underneath. shared caching would be where you put it on your own worker roles, right? So now you're deciding, I want this many gigabytes or whatever that may be. So in that case, you're actually, you know, not co-locating, but you're still getting the same result. It's the same API, it's just a different location for the cache. And that will give you, you know, a sense of isolation between your web roles and all of that activity. So this is more for when you're, you know, really making it and you can afford it, right? So you start with colo and then, you know, graduate to here later. But don't forget to look at it because it really makes a big difference. Queuing costs is another thing that gets people frequently. The reason is because of the polling. So when you start looking at estimating pricing, and I have a really pretty rich example of a pricing spreadsheet that I'm going to show you in a bit. And, you know, everybody's pricing spreadsheet is going to look different. Your business model is different. The way that people use your system is different. The types of features in Azure you're using are different. It varies. And you really have to analyze it. And it can take a long time for you to think through how are the usage patterns in my system and how do I price those. But one thing that is sure, and that is if you are using queuing, then you're polling. And if you're polling, you're paying. So first thing I would say when I think about queues, service bus, and storage is what are the features that you need, of course, because you're not going to choose, you know, based on price alone, right? You first want to think about what are the appropriate features, what are the resources I have to do the work, and what is the financial option. So there are some obvious things. There's a long, long list of queue comparison items, and you know, there's a link to that in the README for the site or for the sample. But these are sort of the key things that matter the most, right? So unlimited, you know, message lifetime is kind of a good one, because when you think about something expiring in 7 days, what does that tell you? Somebody has to be watching. If I never want to lose a message, ever, 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 and that is one of the reasons we use queuing mechanisms, then I need to be watching if I'm using Azure Queues. And if I'm using Service Bus, I can have it automatically go to a dead letter queue, and I could be picking those up and having some other responder do some work, have it notify me, that kind of thing. Message size, you know, typically that's not a big deal, and the reason it's not is because we should be probably tying a queue message to some sort of blob storage if I'm needing to use any significant size. So typically that doesn't come into play as much in my experience. But the total size of storage could matter if you have a crazy busy system. So as a startup, you say, well, probably right away, I'm not too worried about that. But if, you know, you start becoming, you know, Twitter or something, then you might kind of care about that a lot, right? So at that point, that's when they start talking about all of the, you know, NoSQL type of storage being highly, highly elastic and scalable because it's across containers, parallel access, 500 reads per second per container, da-da-da-da-da, right? And it's much, much more optimized. But you're probably not there when you're going live. So when you're going live, your decisions are different. Your decisions are more about cost, but your decisions are also about agility. How fast can I get this up and running, and how much work is it to do it? And the combination of those two things usually means I would go with storage queues first. And the reason I say that is because it's really easy to write a storage queue that does back-off polling. Back-off polling means I poll, I don't get a message, I exponentially increase the interval, I wait now, you know, 10 seconds, and then I poll again, I wait another minute, then I poll again, and I go up to some acceptable interval. If the queue is to send an email that needs to be delivered, like a report, and 15 minutes or more is not an acceptable SLA, then I have to stop at 15 minutes, right? If the SLA isn't a concern, it's more a concern cost, then I can make it go longer. But the idea is I don't have anything in the queue. I'm not going to come back so soon. I'm going to wait, right? Back off polling. So you can do back-off polling really easily with Azure Queue. With Service Bus, you have something called long polling, which means you can go to the queue and have it time out after whatever duration. But the thing is you're holding a thread when you do that. So there's resource-intensive usage involved, and usually you're not going to go more than a minute to poll. So that means you're going to be polling every minute at least, unless you do a custom back-off polling by not using the WCF binding and using custom code, which means I might as well go to Azure Queues if I want to just be agile and quick. Not saying it's not good, by the way, right? I'm talking about startup agility. What do your people know best, and what do you have time to do? Get it done, get it done, get it done, get it out there, but have it be safe, right? Chances of the message expiring in 7 days, you know, I'm hoping that I'm at least monitoring my system daily, and I'm probably going to notice if something disappeared or didn't, you know, was still in the queue. I'm probably going to be looking for that. I have to put some sort of measures in place. So things like order guarantee, dead letter queue, duplicate detection, those are all things that are provided. They're richer in features for the service bus, but it will cost you more. So the question becomes, you know, what kind of system are you building? Is this corporate enterprise, you know, where reliability is the key and the cost is not the issue? Or am I a startup trying to get stuff out there, be agile, and save on costs, and save on the effort, and save on the knowledge needed, and all of the other things that go along with that? Not that it's difficult, but everything adds up, right? So just giving some advice that I've seen that to be a very successful way to approach it. Looking at what back-off polling does, and in general, let's go over here to here. You know, so just again, there's lots of examples about this up here, but here is an example where the monitoring of the storage queue is creating an interval, whatever that minimum interval is, and then essentially I have a maximum. So what's the maximum number of seconds that I'm willing to wait, or minutes I'm willing to wait before continuing? And then this will just increase exponentially if there's no queue, but if there is a queue, then we reset back to the interval, and then that way it's... and then for service bus, it's actually just using a binding, but there's an interval setting in the binding that you can set to a minute or more, but typically I think that's where, you know, you're not going to do back-off polling with that. It's just going to be a setting that says, this is how often we're going to poll. So you're stuck with that, and you're going to have to, you know, write your own code to do back-off polling if you want to do it the way that we're doing with Azure, just to save on the cost. Again, startups care a lot more about the little costs, right? So that's the whole point. Not that it's expensive in the whole, which you'll see when I get to the pricing stuff. Okay. Diagnostics is important. And this is probably no question in anybody's mind. One of the things that I have found really interesting, though, is when you're trying to write a new project and you're working with a team and you're trying to be agile and you're trying to get stuff done and you want to put it live, there's a lot of hacking going on. And that's normal because you're trying to be fast. You got to get stuff done. And there's a fine line between I'm just getting this done, I'm getting it working, it works good enough, and boy, I might be painting myself into a corner, and now we're not going to be able to have visibility into what's going on, and if something is going wrong, boy, how am I going to diagnose that? So there's a couple of things that go hand in hand with this. Number one, if you create some sort of class that's just really easy for everybody to use, because your team might be more than just you, and it says something like diagnosis helper.trace info, trace verbose, trace warning, trace error, or throw. And everybody just has to use that. And maybe there's even a trace method entry function. And everybody just has to use that. Then you've made it easy for the developer to just always use this class, and the rules are what? right? Every time I get into a method, if it's a core method that does something really important, I'm doing federated identity. Oh, I received a message. Yeah, that's important. Oh, I'm about to issue claims. Yeah, that's important. What are they? I'm about to send a response. Oh, that's important. What does that look like? You know what I mean? You get the idea. So the point is, make it easy for everybody on the team to quickly just write the diagnostics so that it's doing the right thing, and then worry about what goes in that class and how you tweak it and make it better, you know, over time. And it's not that hard to make a class that makes this easy for you. So for example, here is a shared library. Excuse me while I scroll. Here's a shared library with a diagnostics helper such as that. It's got throw and throw admin. It's got a bunch of overloads. It's got tracing functions for critical and exceptions when you don't want to throw but you want to trace it as an exception. It's got trace information, trace verbose, and trace warning. Now, what that function can do is use just trace directly, and of course, then you're just relying on the functionality of diagnostics. So for example, you know, in your web role, you're going to have shared listeners and so forth set up. This is just commented out. So you have a trace listener set up, right? And that's all pretty straightforward. But when it's time to monitor, you know, you're basically able to, as if you were on the machine, you're able to go and filter information versus exceptions versus whatnot. So if I double-clicked on this here, and that email that didn't send before, right? So I'm looking at diagnostics from that before. And I say, I just want to see the critical and the error and the warnings, let's say, because there's too many informational ones. Then I can see, okay, both queues are turned off, and that's my message saying I wasn't able to send an email, right? So these are just, you know, things that you throw in the code, like, oh, if somebody sets this the wrong way, then we're going to write a line that says this is a warning. And if somebody sets this the wrong way or an exception is thrown that's uncaught, then I'm going to throw it. But before I throw the exception in the actual application, I'm going to trace it so that somebody can see what was the exception and what was the source of it and so on. So you're just making it easy for people to work together, essentially. That's the whole point. And if you make it super easy to do that, then everybody wins. There. Okay, monitoring from outside is another incredibly important thing because you want to know when it goes down. That's probably even more important to some extent than diagnostics right out of the gate. Because I don't want to be wondering if I have VCs going to my site or new users signing up, whether or not something was down. And this is really easy to do cheaply because there's things like, you know, Azure Ping. Azure Ping is a free service, a free piece of functionality that comes from Paraleap. Paraleap also has Azure Watch, which is a more robust sort of panel where you can set up monitoring and alerts. You know, there are some things now available with the new portal as well that are probably forthcoming too. But the point is, you want to be able to do it from outside. So if I have, you know, this Azure Ping and I enable it, it's probably I've set it up to send an SMS, but it's going to do it through email. So if it detects that my service is not running, then it's going to go ahead and notify me. And probably it won't because I put it on purpose to something that won't run. And it might take, like, you know, 1 minute for that to come up. But in the meantime, we can go and take a look at the kind of things that it lets you monitor. So let's go ahead and take a look at the Azure Ping. There we go. So there's an XML file to configure, and it's got things like, you know, how do you want to send the email? And where do you want to send it to? That's to my phone. This is going to be, you know, scroll down a little bit. What account am I monitoring, right? Don't be memorizing my account key because, like, I might not recycle it fast enough. We've got containers. You can monitor specific containers or blobs. You can monitor specific tables. You can monitor specific queues. Make sure that they're available. You can monitor SQL. And there's my email, right, saying something's not right. So I inspected it. It says error processing. MovieDB, boostacloud.com. So it's not finding that. It's unable to connect, right? So you get the idea, right? Monitoring from outside is, you know, probably one of the most important things. And it just gives you peace of mind, and it's so easy to set up. So there you go. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and you know, a lot of those will have intervals that you can set up. You're talking about how often do you want to ping it, right? But it's a trade-off, right? The cost for the ping versus knowledge of availability. So it's true, you don't want to monitor every piece. I think that it would be sometimes good enough just to have the major endpoints and know that they're alive or not, rather than every single item underneath, for example, because the rest will surface in errors and diagnostics. And errors and diagnostics, by the way, will add up very quickly as well. Because, you know, if you're logging verbose, there's an awful lot of logs. And if you're moving that over to storage, even though individually they're pretty small, and even though storage is cheap, it will start to add up pretty fast. So you got to keep a really close eye on that as well. Like, make sure that, you know, you're offloading it from storage as quickly as possible and not incur all of those costs. And that's one of the reasons why you want to be able to go to config instead, you know, from configuration profile, because then you can change it to verbose when you need it to be, and then otherwise you're probably just logging information level, or sorry, warning and an error information level, as opposed to verbose and so forth, right? Turn that on when you need to and have it recycle when you're running into issues. Okay, so the NoSQL discussion is very interesting. And this is more philosophical. I know people that know stuff and know way more than me about NoSQL, but I've been down this road with a couple of people, and I've had many friends that have gone down this road. So, you know, VCs love NoSQL. They love it. They want people to use it because they think it's the cat's meow. And that's the thing that a VC in the community can do. They can just hear a buzzword and say, oh, if you're not doing that, then you're not, you know, in the in crowd, or you're not doing the right thing. It's true, they do. So there can be some pressure to do things that maybe are not right for you. So we have to have a little bit of a discussion about, you know, just how do we go about NoSQL? So how many people in the room are, you know, SQL DBA or pretty comfortable with SQL Server, you know, RDBMS, so many, right? How many people feel like they understand fully how to leverage NoSQL? Can I get your number? Here's the thing. A lot of the SQL people still stay with SQL, and what we need are SQL people that go to NoSQL and tell us what's the lessons learned and what are the things we're missing and what are the things to do and how to do it right. When I go about these things, I don't trust myself to research it and do all that, right? Not because I'm blind. That's just not related at all. It's because, you know, I'm a consultant. I know what I know really well, and I know what I don't know, I think. And I got to go to somebody who's been there. So here's the thing about NoSQL. I've gone down the road of trying to design a system with NoSQL just because we thought it would be a good idea from the cost perspective. And then the cost of SQL Server came down, and we said, And then I talked to a few people that actually went the NoSQL route, and you know what they said? I delayed my release a year and a half because it took us that long to figure out how to do the framework correctly and how to get the design of the data model correct and how to do the proper partitioning and containers and how to get the relational aspects together. Insanity, right? But that's the truth. The reason that VCs like it, do you want to know why? They like it because they think it's cheaper to manage. Because they say, you don't need a DBA. You're just developers. All you have to do is write some classes, push that stuff into storage, and away we go. Ship it. And they are right to some extent, but what kind of disaster are you going to be left with if you design this without knowing what your data model is and the relational aspects of that model? Seriously. I mean, it's insanity. So I guess the message here is, number one, you may be pushed, if you're in a startup, to go NoSQL, and that's the reason why. They think that that's going to save money. You can try to use your intellect and wit to explain that that could actually cause more problems later, because if I had my, well, I have my approaches with my team, and the way we look at it is, look, I'm going to go SQL because I know it and I understand well enough, even as a developer, a lowly developer, not a DBA, to build a relational data model and get that into SQL, Azure, and get it up there, and the cost is not expensive. And you know what? We'll go live with that because we got like a couple of versions of new features to ship before we're probably even tipping, you know, the edge over on being close to Twitter. I hope to get there, right? But really, let's be serious. You're not going to have that overnight. Get it up in the cloud. Get your data model worked out. Figure it out relationally because we understand that and we know how to think that way. And go to NoSQL for the obvious stuff. Obvious stuff, things like search indexes, supporting location data, like, you know, a lot of people buy geo data, right, to map over to their user profiles. Profile data coming in from Facebook and other places, you know? Things that are not part of your core system but are supporting information and could be massive. And that could get costly. Don't put that in your RDBMS. Put that in, you know. And that's not going to impact you, and it's going to be a little bit more obvious how to store that. But do your data model with RDBMS, and then you know what you do? You go to somebody that knows NoSQL or, you know, the whole big data model, if you think you're going to get that busy. Like, I'm going to shout out, you know, some people I know, and they will help you figure out how to denormalize your data and what's the right way to handle access patterns to NoSQL and which pieces of your data should go there. So just a short picture of denormalization, just for the sake of it. You know, you could have like a table that is partitioned and has Azure entities or some other NoSQL, because there's actually lots of flavors, right? And it's quite possible you'll use more than one flavor of NoSQL in your solution when you go that route, because some of them are better for document-based and some of them are better for row key-value pair, right? And the point is, when you go down that road, if you're doing the denormalized route, you're going to have this concept where you have all these entities, but you're going to put them in a flat line. You're going to denormalize it, and it's going to be crazy. You're going to call one row, and you're going to get every piece of information about the user you could possibly imagine because you made the row so super freaky long. And that's okay, because that's the whole idea. The problem is, how do you think of that in advance? The access patterns. Oh, but I need to relate this to this. It's really nuts. Like, we've gone through it with a couple of people, and it's really hard to do before you've got your model set, before you have an existing application with a solid relational plan to then go look at access patterns. And so this would be, you know, sort of my runtime view, right? My object-oriented relational, which normally would mimic a little bit what's down in the data, but instead I'm flattening all that, right? And you could do that and still produce business entities that are relational. And I would also highly recommend you decouple the Azure entities or whatever entities from your actual, you know, layer above, because your MVC model entities and things like that are not going to look anything like what the guys down below do, and you don't want to be tied to Azure, because that's another thing VCs will push for. Like it or not, they'll be like, well, but if something goes wrong, how easy can you move? Oh, I've decoupled that. I got you covered, dude. That's all I have to say. Check on the box. We don't talk about that again for at least a month. And that's happy times. Really? So I know one person, and I mean literally one person, who is a consultant that knows this stuff inside out, her blog. I had to put it up here because she's awesome. And, you know, it's like if you go and look at all the millions of, you know, YouTube videos she's already put up on all the various NoSQL and so forth, seriously, it's like one of the few people, really the only one, who was a SQL expert, BI expert, who moved over to the dark side of NoSQL and is loving it and living it and really knows how to deal with it. So, you know, when you're doing a startup and you want to get good advice and you think you need it, you hire somebody like that for like 3 days or a week or whatever it is, and it costs a lot maybe, but in the scheme of things, the advice you get, totally worth it, right? That's how I operate. Sharing that with you, just one option. And maybe there's a few others that will start popping up, right? But a lot of my favorite SQL people haven't gone there yet. And I ask them, please, for the love of God, go there. I want to call you. I want you to tell me with your genius brain, DBA, how NoSQL compares. But it's hard to find that in the Microsoft community just yet. There's a lot of non-Microsoft, by the way, right? But you got to find then those people and have them speak my language. Not always easy through all the, you know, yeah, complexity. Okay, tip number 9. Social logins need to be easy. Login needs to be easy. Registration needs to be easy. If you want traction, you want people to come to your site, you want conversion rates. You want people to come to your site and say, I want in. This is really important. It's more of a business thing, but it's so, so important. And, you know, it's really easy to do that with things like access control. So, you know, somebody goes to your site, you fire them over to access control, you get any number of the social, you know, login options presented to you, and you don't have to code it all up. The cost is dirt cheap per transaction, really. You know, so this is one of the number one reasons that I use this service in any experiences that I go through right now. I mean, it does a lot of other stuff too, access control, right? You can federate with other partners that have identity providers, even like ADFS and otherwise. But this is the number one thing that I see it useful for today, because everybody wants to just quickly fire up a social login, and this makes it easy to do. You know, you get that token back from whatever your social login was. It gives you something called a name identifier, which is a unique ID for that user at your site. And then you fire that up and attach it to something. So here's the key, right? When you're attaching it to something, when that comes back, how do you, you know, make it easy? And I noticed this was a little bit slow earlier, but I'll just give it a run. Oh, I got another critical event. I might need to stop that service, or I'm going to start getting some crazy emails. Speaking of costs, you know, when you're just playing around, don't forget to unload those suckers. Not saying I've ever had to pay a bill, but maybe I have, maybe I haven't. Okay, so this is just loading up the Azure environment real quick. Or did I say real quick? Sorry. The emulator. Yeah. Why do people say that anyway, real quick, at the end of the sentence? Can you come over here real quick? Is that like, as opposed to real slow? Yeah, that was funnier in my head, too. Yeah. I made it here with bronchitis, folks, seriously. Thank you. My son's name is Mama, cough again. Juan Pablo. Boy. Thank you for remembering that. That was awesome. Okay. Is this running? I believe it is. Ah, it's just over here. So when I go to somebody's site, and I am an amazing designer, by the way. I forgot to tell you about my web skills, and I don't really promote those in consulting often just because I find it overwhelms people. Ah. Okay, we're almost through the talk. So if I'm going to register, I probably want to come to a page that says, how do you want to log in? Bam, you got me, right? So I go wherever. I go to Windows Live, I go to Google, I go to Facebook. All of those are something that you can set up in Access Control easily. And see how good my password skills are. Oops, I think I screwed that one up. I'm going to try that again. Need to get a good cough out, that's all. I'm going to just run that again because back button not so friendly, yeah? Not okay. Didn't quite do what I wanted. I think probably an IP address. You know, in Access Control, you have to tell it where to reply back to, and if the address changes, then you're kind of in trouble. so, but that demo worked. I'm just saying. Woo! I'm fired up. Look at that. It's working. Okay, so like that, but pretend it worked, okay? What you see afterwards is a simple, give me your name and your email, but don't bombard people with more. You've already logged them in, right? And I'll tell you where the magical code goes. You know, you've basically got a little custom claims authentication provider here. It's going to say, hey, I've got a authenticated user. I've got a name identifier. I've already checked that it came back from one of my trusted providers, Google or Yahoo or Windows Live. But now I've got to look you up and see if you're in my database. And if you're not, then I'm going to send you to registration. So that's what this code does. in a version that works. And I commented it out to show an example, but I think I'll just let you take a look at that offline. But basically it goes to SQL Azure and it uses the Azure the ASP.NET membership database, checks to see if the user's name ID is already there. If it's not, then we just continue. If it is, we go get your email, we go get your name, and we add these claims, because then the code inside, since I can't hit the debugger, here, when we get to the login page, says, hey, if I've already got a claims identity, which I should, then if I don't have a name claim yet, let's go to register account. Otherwise, you're in, because that means I've already found you. If you had the right claim, I found you. If you didn't, I'm going to send you over to Register. And then Register should just grab a couple of quick things and create the user. So the idea would be, don't ask them for too much. The more you ask for the user to enter, how many of you have gone to a site and then you see this list and you, do you leave? Of course you leave. I don't have more than 1 second right now. I thought it sounded like a good idea, and if you, oh, I went to Pinterest. Give me your email for an invite. That's so easy. Thank you for that. And a nice little email that says, oh, we'll get it to you as soon as we can. And then, like, you know, a few minutes later, I actually got it and I felt special. But I didn't have to enter like 5 million things. They just wanted my email so they can reach me. That's it. Keep it simple. You'll get conversions. I'm telling you. Anyway, maybe that's obvious. But I'm passionate about that. I think that's really cool. So using access control, you can do that. Now, here's where the rubber really meets the road. Pricing. This is the best demo of my whole talk. Not just because it works. It's a spreadsheet. It has to work, right? Yeah, no, there's no divide by zero in here. But thank you for that, sir. Here's the deal. You got to look at your service. You got to figure out what your pricing is. You got to look at your VM costs, your storage, your transactions to storage in the 10,000s, you know, per month, that kind of thing, how much they charge. The bandwidth usage is probably the number one thing that can creep up if you're using media. I have done this many ways for different people. And Azure is extremely affordable in general. And anywhere you go, the one place you pay is bandwidth, really. Because, you know, there's layers of costs, right? There's the, I'm a single developer creating my new idea and I don't want to pay $300 a month. And there's the, I'm a startup with a team of three and a little bit of funding, and $300 a month is nothing, right? It's all about perspective. You're the developer, you're gonna obviously keep it super, super lean because you don't wanna pay $300 a month. I mean, you know, I could be buying a pair of shoes with that, or half one shoe. Just kidding. But you know, you get the idea, right? You gotta choose where you're gonna put your money. But the thing that really adds up, the thing that really, really starts to cost you is the thing that I hope you're charging for. So you've got to run some estimates. You've got to do these things. This spreadsheet is not trivial. I have compute costs calculated and then with BizSpark. Oh, wow. But it's got the calculations in there. And I'm not saying this will work for you. You've got to go through this and you've got to make it yours, right? But I've done this many different ways for people. And I change it to look at, you know, how many people are we going to have in Q1, Q2 that are producing media in my service? How many consumers? Well, I made it a factor. Like, each producer has, like, reach of 100 people. What if they reach 500? I don't know. I got to be able to put that number in, and I got to go, what does that do to my total? Well, now I've got, you know, in Q6, $4,800 in costs for bandwidth, because now there's way more people accessing media. Right? Well, what if I go to storage, which is the number one cost point if I'm talking about, you know, media? I got to have an average size. What's the average media blob? Is it 1 meg or 50, right? What if it's 50? Well, if the average size is 50 and I've got a bunch of people uploading, then I guess when I go to my totals, I'm looking at some pretty big dollars over here. And you know what? I'm not charging enough for that, right? Does that make sense? But I'm talking about increasing the number of downloads, but what I haven't done is increased how much I'm charging. or, you know, I mean, I've made a ridiculous number basically, right? So if on average it's more like, you know, 10, then maybe the numbers are more reasonable. But you got to run these numbers. And then you got to look at it with BizSpark. Because BizSpark, if you're part of that program, can give you the first couple of years without costs. The bandwidth still might cost, but less. But everything else is almost zero, truly. And again, you know, I'm assuming you're getting into the program, and I'm assuming that you're working through those numbers. So this is the number one tip of the day. You have to go through the trouble. I've saved you at least an hour by giving you this spreadsheet. Maybe two. Maybe a week or two. I'm not telling. It's a lot of work to put it together. But this is the number one thing you can do, because if you can go to a VC and you can say, I've projected my costs and I've looked at my revenue models and this is how we think we're charging people, and we're going to give everybody who produces media, you know, 200 gigabyte free, and after that they're going to pay 10 bucks a month. On average, we'll assume 50% of those people do that. On average, I'll assume 1% of people actually buy something, but the others are repeat downloads and I'm not getting paid for that. You know, you got to run those numbers. You got to run those numbers. You got to check it out. And you got to plug them in, and you got to look at where your break-even point is. Does that make sense? So that is the number one thing that you're going to want to look at after this session, and that is you want to be downloading that spreadsheet, and you want to make sure you estimate your costs and build a cross-projection spreadsheet. And that was a lot of information, and it was a fireside chat, but the code samples are extremely heavy-duty, and one of them broke before my session, which is why I didn't run my Lucene demo. I apologize for that, but I just wanted to share that with you so that you didn't think, oh my God, what a moron. She actually did the session and she didn't even show the Lucene demo that she kept mentioning. Something really bad happened. But you know what? My pricing demo didn't fail. I'm happy. I'm totally happy. And you know what? I didn't cough through my whole session, so I think that should call it a day. Thank you so much for coming. I really appreciate it. If you have any questions, you can stay and ask, or you can email me, because I like to get emails from people about these things, because it's really fun stuff. Thank you, and have a great night.
Day. Have a question?
And I'll be here all day. Yeah, questions are fine.
Where can we download the spreadsheet from?
Go to dasblonde.net. There is a version of that already posted, but I will be updating that at the end of this week when I have a bandwidth that can upload the big new sample, and it's a new pricing spreadsheet. But there is already one up there if you'd like to look at the Azure samples that are already there.
What was the website?
And the sample that you didn't see, the big Lucene example, is going to be up there as well. But I also have a whole zip of other Azure samples from prior. So it's going to be refreshed, basically. Okay? Yeah. It's michellearubistamante.com.
10 times fast.
That's a mouthful, isn't it? Thank you.